Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Former Vice President Joe Biden came out with an impressive video announcing his candidacy for president the other day. He didn't talk much about the other Democrats, but he focused on President Donald Trump and the racism at that supremacist rally at Charlottesville and the protest over the destruction of Confederate statues and Trump saying there were decent people on both sides of the fight.
And at that moment, I knew the threat to this nation was unlike any I had ever seen in my lifetime. We are in the battle for the soul of this nation. I believe history will look back on 4 years of this president and all he embraces as an aberrant moment in time.
Wow. That sure was some emotional speech, wasn't it, Joe? But here's the thing. I remember other great speeches Biden made. Like when he sounded like Foghorn Leghorn, the cartoon character, talking in the voice of a Southern preacher, or perhaps even a black minister, telling delegates at the NAACP convention that Mitt Romney would put them all in chains. Yeah, Mitt Romney, slave master. Right, Joe?
Romney wants to let the, he said in the first 100 days, he's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
And of course, there's more. Biden explaining people need an Indian accent to go into a 7-Eleven, and that creepy Joe Biden thing, sniffing women's hair, rubbing their shoulders whether they like it or not, trying to kiss that teenage girl, and she almost passed out from the creepiness of it all. So many gaffes, and on tape. And that's the problem in being around for so long. You have a record, Joe, besides that working-class Scranton stick. But here's something amazing. It's another Biden gaffe. And it's not even about hair sniffing. It's about how Biden, then vice president, threatened Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko in March of 2016, threatening to pull $1 billion in Obama U.S. loan guarantees out of Ukraine and send Ukraine closer to insolvency if Ukraine did not fire the prosecutor Viktor Shokin.
I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Oh, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid at the time.
If the prosecutor isn't fired, you take the money away? Joe, you sound like a City Hall tough guy, or maybe somebody from Chinatown. But here's where Biden forgets to tell the rest of the story, that the Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, was investigating a natural gas company that was paying Biden's younger son, Hunter. Uh-oh. Ethics, schmethics. Is this Ukraine, or is this a Chicago way? Now, you get into fired prosecutors and who's making what in Soviet bloc countries, you really can't trust what you're hearing. But it is worth taking a look at. And those journalists who don't mention it, well, they think you're a chumbalone. They don't have to mention it because they figure you're too stupid to care. But I know you care. Liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, you care about your country. Facts are facts. So let's get this sorted out, Joe, about Ukraine, and see how you respond to your fellow Democrats. Because when Joe Biden talks about the battle for the soul of a nation, what he's really talking about isn't America. He's talking about the battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. And he's one of the old souls. And the new Democratic Socialist Party is young, and they want to devour those old souls. Bernie Sanders, off to his left, is another old soul. and the young lefties like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and their mouthpieces who've been arguing in the journals that Biden is too old and too white to lead the Democrats, who are all about racial identity politics. What happens then when Joe is rejected? Do Democrats devour themselves or start splintering American politics into three parties? Conservatives, socialists, and left-center Democrats. We'll see. We're so European these days, aren't we? And we don't even know it. Jeff Carlin, my friend and executive producer of WGN's Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis, is here. And we'll have Gregory Pratt, the Tribune reporter who broke that story about Ed Burke's son, and Tony Preckwinkle and that $100,000 job she got for Burke Jr., and the money Tony Preckwinkle won't give back. And Tribune editorial cartoonist Scott Stannis joins us, as does Adam Schuster of the Illinois Policy Institute, to tell us what Governor J.B. Pritzker is up to, and I hope it's not just Toiletgate. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune. And you? Well, you're not in Ukraine using the might of the U.S. government to muscle prosecutors, are you? No, you're safe. You're here. Not Chinatown, exactly, where you never show up for the spaghetti dinner at midnight, ever. You know where you are. You're on the Chicago way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And now we have Tribune reporter Gregory Pratt, who's really hot lately, okay? He's done some great stuff working on Preckwinkle's campaign and Lori Lightfoot's campaign covering politics. But just so you know a little bit about him, this young reporter made his bones at the Chicago Tribune years ago when his dogged inquest into Lincoln Way High School's finances around 2015 exposed an entire network of wasteful spending. Amazing. Like, the superintendent had like a dog. What did he have? A dog company or something?
They called it Super Dog.
Super.
Oh, right there on school campus, he wanted to train his Australian shepherds.
Yeah, and he got the town to pay for it.
Yeah, nice. Anyways,
my man.
So, Greg Pratt, now that you've been covering politics for the Tribune for about a year now, what's your assessment of the politics of Cook County? And how's Toni Preckwinkle lately? Does she love you as much as I think she does?
I think the answer to that is probably, and she's, she's not one to express her emotions all that much, although she finds other ways to do it. Like she doesn't always talk to reporters. Actually, when we did an interview with her this week, we had a photographer who was moving around a lot during the interview, and she was like, "Are you going to sit still?" And he said, yes, I'm finally about to sit still. And then he moved a little, and she got mad at him for moving around again. And she said, never trust the media.
Well,
pretty funny.
Clearly, she's correct. Now, Greg Pratt did a two stories this week, and I wrote a column off them. They were fantastic. One was his fascinating interview with Preckwinkle, in which Toni Preckwinkle basically says, Greg finds out, that she has 72,000 of the, am I correct, of the $116,000 that she got from Burke, or a sizable chunk that she got in the Burke deal. And she still, that money still hasn't been given back to the donors. And then Greg talked to Lori Lightfoot the next day, and Lori Lightfoot said, torches Preckwinkle and says, give back the money. Amazing. How does she hold on to that money? Why isn't she giving it back?
Well, it's a particularly it's a particularly interesting situation because she went up and down for 3 months on the campaign trail insisting she had returned every dollar from that fundraiser. And Lori Lightfoot never believed her. And for that matter, neither did Susana Mendoza, who you might recall had to give back about $146,000 of Danny Solis's money. And she made a point to donate it to charity and release a copy of the check, and the charity got that money. And Preckwinkle, however, just said, I returned that money, period. No proof of it. And so, you know, I was very eager to look at the campaign finance reports. And Jeff Cohen and Christy Gutowski at the Tribune were my partners on looking at the money itself and the bank account. And it turns out that they didn't. She had returned about 43 from our analysis and kept about 72. And we asked her, hey, what's the deal? And their answer is essentially that the checks are in the mail. And now she's saying some people don't want to accept the money. They want her to keep it.
What fascinated me, Jeff and Greg, was that she told Mr. Pratt, that's to be determined. Like, what are you writing me an inner office email?
Yeah, who's asking?
Yeah, we all live in like cubicle world, like Tony with her bureaucrats. That's to be determined. Give the money back. I mean, the difficulty for when you're writing a straight news story is you can't really call someone a liar. But as a columnist, I think, or an editorialist, you can kind of have an opinion about lies. Is it a lie or is it just a colloquialism? You know, like I meant to tell you that I was giving them money. I told Lori Lightfoot to her face millions of times in debates that I gave the money back, but I didn't really, you know, I'm trying to put my head around that.
It's like a colloquialism, like a recusal, you know?
Right.
Like I think from a plain and simple English perspective, to right. say I returned the money means that you don't got that money in your bank account anymore. And when a huge chunk of it is still in your bank account, I think people would say, that's not what you said. And I think that's why Lori Lightfoot made the point to me. She said, I called her out on it, and she practically jumped out of her chair calling me a liar. And, you know, those two are trying to do a kumbaya
right.
arranged by Reverend Jackson. But I suppose in this case, they weren't able to because, you know, Lori has called Preckwinkle a liar to her face during debates. And, you know, now she's saying, give back the money. You said you would do it. It's not complicated.
And she says, Preckwinkle says, Lori called me a cockroach. That's her defense? She called me a cockroach? I don't have to. What is that about? Where's the cockroach come in?
You know, that was one of the weirdest and kind of silliest moments of the campaign where when the Burke raid started, Lori Lightfoot comes to City Hall and she holds a press conference and she says that Mendoza, Gary Chico, Bill Daley, and Preckwinkle are scurrying like cockroaches in the light saying, not me, not me. And I guess Preckwinkle held on to it because I don't think we even. And shame on us, but I don't think that the Tribune ever actually put that in the story at the time, the cockroaches comment. And so not everybody used it. And I think, obviously, it stuck with Preckwinkle because the first time they were at a debate, Lori Lightfoot calls her a liar and says, you know, you need to elevate the tone of this conversation. And Preckwinkle says, well, you called me a cockroach. And I don't think anybody had thought about it for a while. But obviously, Tony Preckwinkle had. I mean, Tony Preckwinkle has a long memory.
So, hey, you can take the teacher out of the school, but I can't take the school out of the teacher. That's what I feel like. Do you feel like you're sitting there in a classroom to take you back right away? Because every time I've ever met Tony, and it's always found like flashbacks, you know, shuddering flashbacks to seventh grade, and I'm dissecting a frog, and my biology teacher is like yelling at me about what I'm doing wrong. That's what I feel like.
She's pretty, I don't think that's unfair. And I mean, she's always reminding people about her time as a teacher. I think she's very much the teacher still as an educator. Sometimes people compare her to a principal, which I think is meant to be less flattering for some reason. But Preckwinkle, you know, one of the funniest moments, and it's not one of those things that makes a news story necessarily, but she was holding over a county board meeting, and some commissioners were standing off to the end talking to somebody in the audience, and it was getting kind of loud. And Preckwinkle goes, excuse me, and everybody scurries, I suppose like cockroaches, and runs off, you know? And I'm like, wow, this is Toni Preckwinkle, who is a full-grown woman scolding some commissioners who are grown, serious people. I'm going to spare them the embarrassment of pointing out which of them scurried. But I was watching, and I'm like, yeah, that is the boss of this board.
Like a boss, Toni. But you know what? Give back the money, okay? And if you've spent it already, my advice, go to 29th and Princeton. There's a couple guys there who might lend you some money in Chinatown at a higher interest rate than normal, but at least you'll have the cash so you could give it so that Greg Pratt won't have to write any more stories in the Tribune about how you're holding on to the money. Okay, Greg?
Just for the record, she has the money to give it, to donate it tomorrow if her campaign finance report is accurate.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, so she like, has the money.
Like
she's got 70 grand.
I thought maybe she ran out of money and needed an excuse, like maybe lose a couple SUVs or something. All right, thanks, Greg Pratt, Chicago Tribune. You've been doing some great work, and I think, Greg, your stories on Toni Preckwinkle and her and Burke's son getting that $100,000 job basically shaped the entire campaign in a way that had a profound impact on the campaign. And maybe other people might not tell you that, but I will, and listeners of the Chicago Week should know it. Thanks, man.
I appreciate that, and you know, we're just trying to serve the public and inform the public, but thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
I'm here to shout it. Read all about it. Get your paper.
Now we have our next guest, of course, is none other than Scott Stantis, our friend of the show and award-winning editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Mr. Stantis.
Hello, Mr. Cass.
Hey, Scott.
I was
Mr. Carlin, how are we?
Hello.
I was looking on the Twitter feed this morning because that's where journalists get their news and
sure.
Columnists get their column ideas.
Sure. Yeah.
Talk show hosts, everything's Twitter. And I see a tweet from Kristen McQuarrie about this little boy that was killed, A.J. Freund.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, basically, I don't support the death penalty, but sometimes, and she's thinking about the mother and the father
sure.
who beat this little boy to death and left him to die in the cold. And then the next tweet was on the feed was something about a charity for dogs, like the little sad little doggy face. And please, let's give money for this, you know, this little sad little doggy face. And I love dogs, and, you know, and Jeff loves cats, and I love Jeff, so I'll give him his cats.
I like dogs, too.
I know you do, but I'm just saying they're creatures, and
right.
they're not babies. They're not human babies. And just that juxtaposition, Scott, got me.
Oh, are you saying we're out of whack? I mean, the whole culture is. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, Bruce Dold, who is now the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, won a Pulitzer Prize when he was a columnist for the Tribune on this very subject of a kid who was, DFS had given the kid back to the mama who was clearly crazy and sadly killed the kid. And how, you know, we should, you know, fix this problem. And this was in the 80s, I believe.
Right. More than 20 years ago, and it hasn't been fixed.
No, and because, well, we don't put resources towards it. We don't address the systemic problems with DFS, which is turnover is massive. We pay social workers next to nothing and expect them to do Herculean work.
And give them hundreds of cases
right.
to deal
with. Because someone leaves, two people leave.
Right.
And all of a sudden you've got... So, and that, to me, is one of the places where government does serve a viable and real purpose. You know, you can look at a million other places to cut. But this is one of those areas, and it's law enforcement as well. And I think that it's reasonable to put resources towards this. I mean, would this have prevented this case? It can't prevent every case. You and I know how this works. But it's going to be better. And if we address it in a serious grown-up way, we can improve the situation significantly, and we won't have stories like this.
She's a drug addict. He's a drug addict. He's a lawyer or a former lawyer who became a drug addict. Liar, which all drug addicts are liars. And we're moving toward legalizing drugs even more so now in this state because we're so, our political class is so bankrupt in every way that the next thing I, what they're going
to
do.
I'm saying thank you to John. You can't see this.
I thought you were giving me some sort of reverse mutzah.
No, no. Yeah, I'm saying thank you because
we're doing.
No one else is talking
this
way.
When are we going to make 16-year-old girls prostitutes so that we'll have money? I mean, when will that happen? Because we're doing drugs, get high. We're telling them to gamble.
Yeah.
We want them to gamble. We want to take their money.
The city of Chicago wants to run a casino. I mean, you know, right, Rahm wants to be, you know, the guy with the pinky ring, right?
Right. He always did, though. He always wanted to be that, like Michael Corleone. I even gave him a portrait.
Yeah.
So he could look like that.
It's crazy, this rush to legalize marijuana, in my view. First off, full disclosure, I never liked it. So I wasn't one of those art majors who...
I did.
Sure. Okay.
Well, and, big time.
And I don't... hey, we had friends who... A married couple who actually budgeted it into their monthly budget.
Sure. Yeah. Wow, so, lots of that.
Yeah, they were responsible. They were saying, we're going to spend this much on weed every month.
How much did they put for gas to get the Denny's for the... brownie sundae at 4 a.m.
Oh, John, that's just a nasty stereotype. I did stuff. Did you see the cartoon I did on Pritzker wanting to legalize marijuana?
Yeah, yeah, it was hilarious. I got some. That's why I brought this up.
Screaming at me about as much as you can scream on Facebook. You're making fun of fat people and people who do weed. What's wrong with you? Blank you.
Because you do weed and you sit on your ass and you eat brownies.
Yeah. Oh, but that's just a stereotype. According to an article that came out this week, people who smoke weed are skinnier or have a lower average weight than people who don't.
Scott Stennis, what are we going to do in this state? And this, we're going
to
have the Illinois policy people on that are going to come on the program. Scott and I were in a editorial board meeting a couple days ago in which they came in and talked about these issues that we're facing. But just generally, Scott, what do you think of the state doing all this tax work, trying to get revenue, and not, I mean, in sort of a mad scramble that doesn't seem to be.
What do? You move to Indiana. You move to Wisconsin. You move what people are doing here. We're losing hundreds of thousands a year in this state, and there's no one in Springfield seriously talking about cutting the budget. I mean, whenever you bring it up, and I know you've had this experience as well, John, whenever you bring this up, they say, we can't do that. We're at bare bones now. And you go, oh, my God, are you kidding me? Please tell me you're kidding me. But they're not kidding you. So there's no serious adult conversation about cutting spending first. They're not making any case to me, to you, to anyone who lives in this state, to why they should raise taxes that and making the case that they're actually spending the money they're taking in now responsibly.
But I do hear read stories, guys, and I watch them on television and listen to them on radio, where the advocates of spending are on, and they're given basically a blank slate to talk as long as they want, or a whole article about how they need the money now. Like, for example, Jesse Sharkey, is he the son-in-law of the Carnival Cruise Line, or is it the other one? Other huge multi-gajillion dollar.
We're tapping
company.
Your encyclopedic knowledge of cruise lines, Jeff.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, he's like one of those champagne socialists with a lot of money, and he's running the CTU, and he's telling Johnny Perez in the paper, we're going to do this and this, and we want to organize, and Lori Lightfoot has to do this, and we're going to strike, and you know he's throwing his marker down, the gauntlet. Where is the pushback? I mean, even in stories. Royal Caribbean. Thanks, Jesse. Sorry, Jesse. That's a, man, that's an expensive. Well, you married well, my friend. It's nice to be a socialist when you married the heiress of the Royal Caribbean.
It makes it easier.
Absolutely.
but where's the pushback journalistically? When you do a cartoon.
Yeah.
He looks at me. It's a rhetorical question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Scott and I are one of the two people in print journalism left who are conservatives in this city.
I think that's probably true.
right? It's a few others, Kristen, I would say, a few others, but that's it. We're one of the few. So where is the, when you write a cartoon that mocks the gargantuan appetites of these Falstaffs of the left who want to eat everything and leave nothing for the taxpayers who are humbly leaving, you know, quietly as refugees, what kind of pushback do you get?
Probably the same that you do. I get the cross, you get either the condescending smile, like you give at the special child,
right.
Or I get the sneer. I get a lot of sneers. Just.
So where are we, Jeff? Are we at a tipping point now? Because we'll be talking to the Illinois policy guy in a second, but are we at a tipping point?
Yeah, we're definitely at a tipping point. I mean, although if you believe all the ads and the hype, JB's tax plan is going to save the day, like riding in on this wave of cash because all the millionaires in the state they can't afford to leave the state and take their business elsewhere to other states where the taxes are so much lower.
I'm not a millionaire, but I might take my business elsewhere.
Well, that's the joke. I mean, that's the gag. Right. And they say, well, look at all the other states in the country tax their millionaires at a higher rate. In Illinois, we don't.
Didn't
Yeah, they also don't have, they also don't tax them on their property as much. They don't, I mean, all the other states, they make up for it in other ways and still makes it enticing to be in their states.
I'm not talking out of school here, but I was speaking to a group of, there was a wealth management group, and these guys are, you know, crazy. You know, they make in a week what you and I make in 5 years.
Yeah, they work in finance as opposed to everyone else.
So I asked, how many of you are going to be here next year? How many of you will be Illinois citizens next year? Only one guy held up his hand. They're all working towards moving to Florida and living there 6 months and a day out of the year. That's what's happening. That's where the rich are going. And I swear to God, in the newsroom and everywhere else, well, good riddance to bad garbage. The rich pay the 70% or more of the taxes of income taxes. That's how this works.
And not even just individuals. I mean, the idea that it's just the rich people make tons of money and then they should pay more taxes. It's the businesses. It's the jobs that come with the people who have money to spend to invest in businesses and wares and essentially drive the economy. The number one employer in the state is anybody? The government.
Yeah.
But you know what, though, Jeff? This is the point where in the podcast where this is like being in a time machine because I can tell what's going to happen in the future. And in the future, Jeff screwing around, listening to me, my voice, and trying to find toilet sounds because this is the week where J.B. Pritzker, Governor Plumber's helper, wants to raise our taxes. The FBI apparently is investigating him, his wife, and their butler, their female butleress, Christine Lovely, or whatever her name is, aptly named like from a Hallmark mystery.
That sounds like from an Archie comic.
Right.
Christine Lovely. And he wants to raise taxes while the feds are looking at whether he defrauded taxpayers on $300,000 remove the toilet deal? Isn't that awkward?
Not to mention the money that's offshore attached to him, allegedly.
But that's not illegal.
It's not illegal, but it's unethical. It's unethical to say, you know what? I'm going to tax people because I can, but I'm going to hide my money because I can. What the hell is that?
Well, because that's the Chicago way, man. Yeah, just because the grandfather was a tough guy.
But it wasn't
like this Pritzker kid.
It's the idea that the governor is going to blatantly spit in our faces about taxes, and then behind his back, he's got a spray bottle, and he's not, you know, he's, oh, I didn't spit on you. No, I got you. Oh, no, I didn't. You know, it's so disingenuous.
So how does he raise his taxes now?
I have no idea. I mean, well, he'll still do it. He's got a supermajority. I mean, so it's going to pass. And
like I couldn't believe that he even got elected with that hanging over him. You know, that he's ripped out the buying another mansion next to your own mansion. It's like something you can't even make up in a cartoon.
Right? John, who amongst us hasn't done that?
Right.
Oh, wait.
And then I'm going to rip out the toilets.
I don't know how the hypocrisy is glaring. And I don't know. I mean, and if it goes to a statewide vote, then I don't think I see it passing anyway. Another side of the exodus is not just millionaires are leaving, but 250,000 people on the south side of Chicago have left in the last 10 years, and those aren't rich people. Those are people who pay taxes, try to do the best they can, and are, well, the only way to put it is they're getting screwed.
We've talked about this, too, before. We've had people on to talk about this, but you look at Detroit as an example, and when the black middle class started to leave Detroit, that was the plug out of the bottom of the tub, and the whole city went with it. I mean, it wasn't just because they were taking resources with them or anything. It just happened that they were the last ones who were being pushed up against the wall. And once they left, there was no one else to push it up against the wall.
The Sun-Times had, and it's on my desk, John, if you want to swing by and see it. It's because it's graphic, and that works for me because that's what I do. But it's the most...
Because I need pictures.
I need pictures. Shut up. There's nothing wrong with pictures, John. But it's a graphic of the middle class, I think it was, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, and what it is today. It's gone in Chicago. I mean, it has evaporated. And so you're going to have a city that's like San Francisco. You're going to have millionaires, and you're going to have the homeless. Nothing in between.
But not only Chicago, because that kind of thinking extends throughout the county. Okay? The county, Cook County, where high property taxes, among the highest in the country.
Yeah.
People are getting killed, and they're wondering, what am I getting in return?
Yeah, if you had golden services, if the streets were flat, right, and potholeless, if the cops were, you know, if every street corner was safe in the city, you'd say, okay, yeah, you know what? You're doing a great job. You come to me and you say, I need a X percentage increase.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I don't like it, but yeah. But that's not what's happening. I mean,
not even close.
No. And if you live downstate, you can't be happy with the services that the city is, the state is providing you, right? I mean,
On another subject, the Rahm, there's a little war going on between Rahm and Rocky Wirtz, who's Jeff's favorite owner and mine too. Rocky owns the Blackhawks, and he's from that real estate empire family, and he basically sent up a memo to Lori Lightfoot on her transition team saying, Lori, I hope you're not going to be a jerk to the business community as was Rahm. And Rahm lost it.
What did he do?
He went into Cranes, and my buddy Jim Kirk gave him some space, and he goes all over ripping on Wirtz, talking about crony capitalism and deals that he got and this and that and the other thing. And I'm thinking, Rahm's talking about crony capitalism after he gives $1.6 billion to the, I don't know, I guess we're supposed to call them Sterling Bay and not the Crowns, but they got a lot of money, they got a billion-dollar TIF,
yeah,
and more, and he's talking, he has the audacity. I mean, sometimes I can't, it just flies at you, so, you know, you've ever feel like wearing a hat, like where you just have to wear a hat because, I mean, this town, the politics of this town and state are just, they're unbelievable. They're just unbelievable.
No, they are. It's, and the hypocrisy, and here's the problem. I mean, this ties into the death of journalism, and you can't, you know, the people don't know a lot of what you're talking about. They learn it through your column, which is very popular, and your podcast. You know, the fact is that they can say, you know, they can take my coffee cup now and say, I believe everyone should have a coffee cup, because nobody is informed enough to know that, you know, 10 minutes ago they took my coffee cup.
And you can't say when Sharky's screaming or whoever, and this is not to pick on a personality, even though I've never gone on a cruise to, what is it again? Carnival Cruise?
Royal Caribbean.
Royal Caribbean. I would assume that somebody's going to challenge Mr. Sharkey for CTU leadership after they spent, I don't know how much money they spent hand over fist electing four socialists to the city council and losing Tony Preckwinkle. I mean, my God, what a disaster. At least the SEIU knows how to run campaigns, and they kind of made it close. But
so they're going to start the council meeting with the Internationale now instead of?
Nice.
Just asking.
I would think so.
Arise, ye children of starvation. Come on, everybody. Arise, ye wretched of the earth.
Wait, those are the English lyrics to this.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, It's not like Kate Smith singing a Paul Robeson song that he sang.
How stupid is that story, John? Oh, my God.
I mean, look, it's a terrible song, but Paul Robeson sang it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's sarcasm, I think. I wouldn't even want to be associated with the song because you know how it is in this modern life that we live in.
Well, you'd never record it today. There's no question. But the fact is, it wasn't recorded today. It was recorded in 1930 when, you know, 20% of homes had phones. You know, I mean, things were different.
Yeah. My problem is in that issue where Kate Smith, who, you know, the big belting voice that she had, is now a persona non grata in Philadelphia. Because she recorded a song, That's Why the Darkies...
Two songs, actually.
Yeah, two.
I read like that.
But they're racist songs,
Oh, basically. God, yes.
But were they racist? Or then why, if they were racist, why would a avowed communist leftist leader like and great artist like Paul Robeson, who thrilled the world with his voice, and I can imagine, just think of him singing Mighty Mountain... You know?
No, he's amazing talent.
He's just amazing talent. And also a football player, by the way. You know that. He was a great football player. Why would he sing it?
I think you touched on it. I think it was satire. I don't know, but I'm going to guess it was.
Maybe he just got paid and didn't care.
Well, and they had, you know, a friend of mine collects those old cylinders, right? And there's a lot of songs like that.
I mean, this all goes back to the idea that, remember, art is a mirror of culture, right? I mean, right. That's exactly all. Well, it is.
What are they trying to do? They're trying to erase.
They're trying to. Well, it's the idea.
Bad things happen, so we gotta get rid of all history.
It's the kind of hipster mentality. You know, you have to be. Now that I know, I have to be super about it. You know, oh look, I'm running out in front of everything, and you know, I can't say, hey, here's a plaque of somebody who was a very talented artist who grew up in a different time. I mean. You just wouldn't do that. You can't do that now, apparently. I mean, it's the idea that, okay, so then take the plaque and be like, hey, change the inscription on it, you know, was a fantastic talent and a wonderful voice and also, unfortunately, recorded some racist things because it was a different era, but she's still really good. I mean...
Yeah, you can acknowledge, I mean...
It's not like someone all of a sudden produced evidence where she was... enslaving people or abusing people or physically harming people. But it was the idea that, again, she was an artist and she was just reflecting culture.
Are you telling me that Kate Smith did not put entire generations of poor people identified easily by the color of their skin on welfare and destroyed their families and destroyed their economy and basically drove fathers out of the home and all that?
That's the power of music, John.
Oh, no, that she's just a singer.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But those who do that kind of thing, they're called heroes, right? They're heroes to some.
Community organizers.
Or aldermen.
Or, you know, politicians, right?
Or aldermen. I gotta say, I took a bus. A friend of ours opened up a meadery. Go ahead and give me that look, John.
What is a meadery?
They make mead.
Mead.
Mead. M-E-A-D. Like honey wine.
Stop where you are. Here's my image of your friend. Portly?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Bull-headed haircut, wearing a Kirtle Friar outfit with several beehives on poles behind him.
I can't say what he wears in the privacy of his own home, but
a finely waxed mustache. That's what I imagine.
No, he has no facial hair. He actually makes wine and mead. He's an award-winning mead maker. And they have a meadery, and they opened up, and they invited us down. So we had some friends from out of town, and
Where's the meadery? Tell me.
It's down in Beverly.
Okay.
And we couldn't figure out how to take the train, which stops. The metro
Rock
stops
Island.
Literally less than half a block from the meadery. We couldn't figure it out. So we said, let's just take the bus.
Okay. Beverly from your home?
Yes, from downtown to.
Did you take Western? How did you get
it? Ashland?
Yeah, the Ashland bus.
All the way down. Now, here's the thing.
I saw the sunset. All right, that's nice.
No, here's what I saw though, and I saw these wards, and it made me furious. And I don't live there. I live in the Loop, where things get shoveled, where things get taken care of, where you have a bazillion police officers making sure crime doesn't happen. And it happens anyway. And then I drive through these areas, and there's in the middle of winter, snow had not been removed. Services clearly aren't being provided to these people. Why they keep reelecting people like Sandy Jackson was one person who popped into my head because, and I'm thinking, my God, these people deserve so much. Why don't they feel they deserve the same services I'm getting? And it comes back.
Because if you vote one party all your life, people take advantage of you and they mock you and they call you a great Democrat while you're basically cutting your own throat. And there are people who think independently, but they're not voting.
Yeah. But I just want to say real quick that I did two things. I want to finish the story by saying I did see this kid who looked dangerous because, you know, I'm a middle-aged, doughy white guy. He got off that bus three times during that whole time to help old ladies, older women get their carts into the bus. I mean, and just because that was the right thing to do. It was amazing. But I want to say to you, to Jeff, to your listeners, I open invitation. I record the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus Mondays at noon. So I want to have an open invitation. I would love to have you on. And you too, Jeff, if you want to join us.
That would be great.
We do it in one of the podcast bays, so it might get a little cozy.
A little nice and toasty in there too.
You and Janine, right?
Yeah, my wife, my wonderful wife, Janine is the co-host. And we talk.
You can find it on WGN Plus.
You can.
And for those looking for Scott Stennis when he's not in the newspaper, they can find him on Twitter. At Scott
Stantis.
S-T-A, just one word, right?
Yes.
S-T-A-N-T-I-S, or on Facebook, and obviously Prickly City. Is there any other social media?
GoComics.com/Prickly City, or GoComics.com/Stantis.
Please patronize him in a good way, because not like, do not patronize me.
Pat him on the head.
Right, do not pat him on the head, because there are only a few of us left. And we meet in cells of three, so they can't break us all. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Jeff.
There's strength in numbers, everybody knows. Between us, we'll have 20 fingers, 20 toes. No one should ever be known.
And now joining us on the Chicago Way is Adam Schuster of the Illinois Policy Institute. Hello, Mr. Schuster.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Adam, what's your official title over there?
I'm the Director of Budget and Tax Research.
So no small task.
Yeah, not in Illinois. I mean, there's never a shortage of budget and tax problems to work on, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, we've met just a few days ago, radio time, at the Tribune. You had a meeting with the editorial board. You've been going around, I would assume, talking to other editorial boards as well?
That's right, yeah, we've been doing a tour of editorial boards all across the state. Illinois Policy Institute, we've had some people join us from Ideas Illinois and Representative Dave McSweeney. Mostly what we've been talking about is this fight for the progressive income tax, or the graduated income tax constitutional amendment.
How can one raise the income tax when you're under investigation for the toilet scam? By that, I'm referring to Governor Pritzker.
Yeah, well, I think that scandal is instructive for a couple of reasons. And the first is, he's asking you to trust him to make the tax code more fair. And at the same time, he's doing everything he can to reduce his own tax burden, not only the removal of the toilets to skimp on property taxes, but also, you know, hiding income in offshore accounts in the Bahamas and things like that. And I think what's really interesting about that...
But that's for the children.
it quite clearly proves our point and makes him a hypocrite, because their whole thing is people aren't going to leave if you raise their taxes. People don't change their economic behavior when you raise their taxes. And he's living proof that that's not true.
So you think more people will leave?
Absolutely. So we've already had, since 2014, we've had five straight years of population loss. We've lost 157,000 people. Just last year, it was the first time Illinois' every metro area across the state lost population last year, with Chicago leading among them. And when you ask people why they're leaving, which I think is probably the best way to figure out why, the number one thing they say is high taxes, or taxes are lower in other states. There's a few big polls out there showing that. And the number two thing they say is job opportunities. And job opportunities are also directly tied to the tax burden. We've got some economics research from our chief economist, Orfe Devungi, who is with us at the editorial board meeting as well, that shows this progressive income tax would harm small businesses the most, and it would harm job creation. So it's really not a fair plan for the people who are going to be out of a job as a result of this. And because of that, when you weaken the job opportunities and people are paying more to get less, as they have been in Illinois, it will absolutely make our out-migration problem worse.
Now, people say small business, I mean, there's like a standard soundbite. Small business hires more people than most of the people, et cetera, and yeah. without them, we're nothing. But how does this work from, according to the research? Higher income, higher tax, a progressive tax, how does that literally, I mean, directly affect small business?
Well, so there's a couple of things about it. First of all, the small businesses create about two-thirds of new jobs in the state of Illinois. It's true that small businesses across the United States create most new jobs, but it's especially true in Illinois, even more so than other states. And there's two ways that this primarily harms them. The first is it increases the individual income tax rates. And so the governor's plan would increase the individual income tax rates for everybody making over about $250,000. Well, that just so happens to catch a lot of small businesses because there's a lot of small businesses that are pass-through entities that are taxed at the individual income tax rates. And so you're taking more money away from them, and the more money you take away from them, the fewer jobs they can create, the fewer people they can hire, and the less they can afford to pay them. So it also has a negative impact on jobs growth. But the governor also wants to raise the corporate income tax rate, and the constitutional amendment he's proposed would actually allow for the highest corporate income tax rate in the country. It would legally allow a corporate income tax rate up to 15.22%. And that also catches a lot of small businesses because there's a lot of people, you know, who have 50 or 100 employees that are incorporated. And if you raise their taxes, it's the same thing. They have less money available to hire people and grow jobs.
Why should Jeff and... Please, I'd like to know what you think, too. Why should someone work? Like, if I'm gonna be taxed at 250 or say 150, whatever the number is,
yeah.
Why should I work harder to surpass that?
Well, and that's exactly what it does. I mean, a graduated income tax where you pay higher rates the more you earn reduces people's incentive to invest in education. It reduces people's incentive to work extra hours or to try to climb that ladder and earn extra income. And you can see this when you look around the country. The last state that switched to a progressive income tax was Connecticut in 1996. And since the switch, basically all the promises that are being made in Illinois were also made in Connecticut, and 100% of them were broken. The middle income tax saw their taxes go up by 13%. Property taxes continued to rise. They've had unbalanced budgets in 12 out of the last 15 years, and poverty went up by 47% from 96 to 2016 at a time when poverty rates in other states were falling as a result of the economic expansion through the 1990s and 2000.
If anyone wants to read this stuff, where would they go to read the numbers that you just presented?
IllinoisPolicy.org. We've got a scholarship guarantee. We've got all our sources in there for you. You can see all the complete research on what's happened in Connecticut and also our modeling of what this tax plan would likely mean for Illinois taxpayers.
One of the things I think with a lot of people, when we've seen this, is a lot of people are leaving the state because not just so much as they see like the taxes on their dollars and all that, they see the property value versus the tax rate versus other states. I mean, my family is, they're trying to say, well, you know, my brother's trying to flee the state because he's yeah. like, if I stay here another year, that's $5,000 extra I have to pay versus if I was living in any other state.
Yeah.
And can you break down some of those numbers? Because that's the stuff I don't think people really even contemplate, because until you're up against a wall or until you're up with the idea that you think you're ready to move, probably people don't run the numbers in their own home like that versus another state.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So property taxes, we have the highest or the second highest property tax rate on average in the nation. I did the math with my dad, actually, because he was considering getting a home up here. He currently lives in Florida. And on the same value home, he'd be paying four times higher property taxes in Illinois compared to Florida. And it's, you're right to say it's not just that the taxes are high. It's also that people aren't getting any value for it, right? So it's one thing to pay a really high tax burden and get great services. You've got wonderful schools. Your roads are all fixed. It's another thing to pay more and get less. And that's what we've been doing in Illinois. We've been paying higher taxes, not property taxes. In 1996, Illinois was about the national average. And as of 2016, we were the second highest in the nation, according to our research. And over that time period, the vast majority of new property tax dollars adjusted for inflation went to pensions. It didn't go to schools. It didn't go to your roads or local services. And it's the same thing at the state of Illinois. Your income tax has gone up twice in the last 8 years. It went up in 2011. They promised it'd be temporary. They broke that promise and made it permanent in 2017. And it's the same thing. It's all going to pensions, right? About 27% of our state budget goes to pensions. That's up from about 4% in 1990, right? So over a quarter of every dollar you send to the state of Illinois goes to pay for yesterday's government and doesn't give you any better services as a result.
And just in that instance alone, I mean, tacking all the other money we're owing, all the other stuff this state is due. What's the total per dollar that goes to stuff that isn't any service at all?
Well, yeah, so there's a couple big items I would point to. The fastest growing areas of the budget are government worker health insurance and pensions. Since the year 2000, our spending on pensions has gone up by 677%. It's gone up by 244% for healthcare. Education's only 78%. All their spending's 18%, right? So you can see where the problem is. And the reason I bring up those numbers, the fact that pensions and government worker health insurance are going so much faster than everything else, is because in his budget address, Governor Pritzker pulled this really interesting sleight of hand where he presented a false choice. He said, if you don't give me $3.4 billion in new tax revenue, actually it's $4.5 billion because he's got about $1 billion of other tax hikes, that he has to slash services. He's now saying that if you don't give me my tax hike, I have to cut services across the board by 15%.
But which sounds very familiar, because I feel there was a governor recently in the state that ran an entire platform like that.
Yeah, Pecklin, right?
Yeah. And again, we had time to maybe, you know, see the forest for the trees, but we haven't gotten there.
Well, yeah. The interesting thing is he says everything else would have to be slashed by 15%, but he sets aside two items. He says, if you set aside pensions and government worker health insurance, you have to slash all services by 15%. Well, why are you setting those two things aside, right? If you just looked at the math, that's where we need to be looking for savings. Those are the areas we need to find savings reforms. And so by setting those two things aside, he's essentially presenting a false choice between tax hikes and service cuts. But we've put together a plan, which we talked about last time when it was at the Tribune editorial board, that would balance our budget immediately in the first year, would protect education and social services and the things that people actually care about from their government, and it would completely eliminate our debt over 4 years and enable us to have a deficit-neutral income tax cut. Because I still remember that under the 2011 law, the tax hike that they passed, we're supposed to be on a road to a 3.25%.
Right.
And so when Pritzker says he's giving people a tax cut, or middle-income taxpayers a tax cut, you have to ask what your baseline is. You just saw your taxes hiked 2 years ago, right? And so everybody's still paying more in taxes than they would have prior to that. And that tax hike was supposed to solve all our problems, but our debt burdens and our deficits have only grown since. So if tax hikes worked, why are we talking about another one, right?
Right.
Well, if this is such a great plan, and I'm sure it is, why aren't the Democrats and John Cullerton and Mike Manigan clamoring, knocking on your door, the Illinois Policy Institute, please, I don't want to be the knight king. I want to be the speaker. Please help me. Give me your plan.
Yeah.
Why aren't they doing that?
It's politics. That's a simple answer. I mean.
But I mean, what in it rubs them the wrong way?
Well, pension reform is the biggest one. So, you know, there's this new line that the governor's been using, which on his tax hike, which is just let the people vote, right? Because the way this works is first the constitutional amendment would have to pass the General Assembly, and then it would go to the ballot for voters. Well, why won't we just let the people vote on pension reform? Because in order to really tackle our debt burden on pension and this ridiculous amount we're spending per year on pensions, 27% of our budget, we first need a constitutional amendment. And we've proposed a constitutional amendment that would protect every dollar earned by every government worker today and every pensioner, would not cut a dime. All it would do is grow their benefits more slowly, and it would give the General Assembly the power to do that. And so far, that's what both the governor and lawmakers down in Springfield have been unwilling to touch.
How many people are in unions that work for the government in this? What's the percentage?
You know, I don't know the percentage who are in unions.
Because
but
Jeff said, you know, as we know, largest employer in the state is the state. Right?
I can tell you that when you add up all the state and local pension systems, it's over a million people, which is about 8% of our total population.
So 8% of the population dictates policy for everyone else. So in other words, we are like a Balkan nation after World War II when the communists took over. Is that what you're telling me? Because that's what it's like. 8% took over Greece. I know that. It was 10, but
you know they're very politically active. They're a minority, but they're a very loud minority. I think it's either today or early next week. There's a rally that they're going down there to argue in favor of hiking taxes, so that there is more money to pay for their pensions and healthcare. And it's that's why they get paid attention to, because they're a loud vocal minority.
And there's no pushback in media generally. I mean, I just saw something, and again, I'm not trying to pick on Mr. Sharkey, who is the Jesse Sharkey, as we mentioned, is the married the heiress of the Carnival Cruise Lines,
Royal Caribbean.
So it's nice to be a champagne socialist in real life, right? And so you have all that money, but you can have your credentials. He's demanding money out of the city of Chicago for CTU contracts, and there's no pushback in media. Like, wait a minute, dude. There's no money.
Yeah.
Building that Obama temple, for God's sake, that's money. There's no money. No one says there's no money.
Well, and there's no money.
So people leave.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing is, it's not only you're paying more, you're getting less, and we still have huge debt burdens, right? There's a group called Truth in Accounting that figures every taxpayer in the state of Illinois owns $50,800 of debt, about $51,000 of debt just for the state of Illinois. So not only are your taxes already high, and not only are you not getting great services for those high taxes, but you've got this huge debt burden, which seems to suggest that without major spending reforms, they're going to go up in the future. And I should say, when I talk about spending reforms on government worker health insurance and pensions, it's not about demonizing state workers. It's not about taking away what they've earned. I've got government workers in my family. My father was a 30-year career firefighter. He's getting a public pension. My aunt's a teacher, and I care about their government, about their retirement security. The point is, it's short-term thinking, right? In the long run, we're endangering their retirement security by continuing to run this system that's just simply not sustainable. And if it goes insolvent, they're not going to get any money anyway. Right. So
I'm the father of a young man. My wife's a teacher, and one of my sons, not the one studying accounting, the one who wants to be a teacher, just submitted his forms, his papers. So if anybody needs a great soccer coach and special ed teacher out in the western suburbs, let me know. But he's going to be, I wonder if the boys are going to have to leave the state. That's what worries me.
Well, and that's who I should leave the state. I mean, that's the group of people that are leaving. There's this myth out there that it's older folks going to Florida
like
to retire.
Yeah,
and that's not what the data shows. So we've actually dug into the census data, and the group that's leaving the fastest is prime working age adults, and they're leaving because they're paying more in taxes and getting less in services.
Jeff, is that the demographic that radio stations love? Prime working age.
Luckily for us, radio waves go beyond borders. So we have a strong listenership in Indiana and Wisconsin and even parts of Michigan. But so,
Tennessee.
So some of the, I know the kind of the pushback on a lot of the idea of reforming pensions as well. I'm 5 years from retiring, or I'm 10 years from retiring. Now I'm not going to be at this level. I'm going to be at another level.
Yeah.
But then someone starting now is not going to be anywhere near, they think that the person who's retiring, 5 years from now. What is that kaleidoscope? I mean, how does that change from someone who's, say, starting a job as a teacher now versus someone who's halfway through their career versus someone who's, right at the end of their career?
Yeah. So in the long run, we do need to create a new pension system that's sustainable and affordable, and so we don't keep getting into this crisis, every decade or so. And that should be probably something like a defined contribution system, where like a 401k style. There's other options out there. But there's a lot of benefits to it, too. I mean, it also gives you a portable retirement account that you can bring with you from employer to employer if you don't want to spend 30 years working for the state. But for people who are already in the system, we've proposed a specific set of reforms that fix the problem. Okay, we'd be spending about $1 billion or $1.5 billion less per year on pensions while paying it off faster than planned under current law, paying the debt off faster than planned under current law with these reforms. And all you had to do is raise the retirement age slowly for people under the age of 45 to more closely match what private sector retirement ages are. So for tier one teachers, that's people hired before, or tier one government workers on average, people hired before 2011, they can retire as early as 50 if they use the early retirement age, which they get a little bit of a benefit cut for that, or 55 is the normal retirement age. So, I mean, right. Social Security is moving up to 67 right now, right? So if you're a private sector worker who's paying for these pensions, you're waiting till 67 to retire while they're retiring at 50. And, you know, that's not fair, first of all. And it's too expensive. We can't afford, especially when life expectancy is longer than right. It's ever been.
And that's the thing that blows people my mind, and I don't think people understand that, is that, say, somebody does retire next year making, you know, $60,000 a year, which is fantastic for a teacher in the state.
Yep.
And plenty of teachers in the state deserve that and work for that. Let's say that's we're talking, you know, high end here, but they retire at 55. And they die at 85, just saying, throwing an average there. I mean, it's 30 years, and they're getting 3% every year, and it's compounded every year. So by the time they were actually physically die, they're making six figures. And it's insane.
So that 3%, and it's not, so it's not a COLA. So a COLA is a cost of living adjustment, right? This is a guaranteed post-retirement raise.
Right.
Because it's not indexed to inflation, so you can't call it a cost of living adjustment because it's not adjusting for cost of living. So that guaranteed raise doubles the size of somebody's pension over the course of 25 years. So if you retire and your pension's 60 grand, after 25 years, it's 120.
Right. And so, it blows my mind. I mean, the American dream should be, you know, by the time I hit 50, I should be making six figures, right? I mean, that would be fantastic for everybody. It shouldn't be, I'm going to retire and then I hope to make six figures, because that's just not how it works. Well, it's upside down.
And we have 19,000 public pensioners in the state, well, actually just in the state retirement systems, who are making six figures right now, 19,000. And so I want teachers to have a good, secure retirement. I think they deserve it. The thing is, I've had an opportunity to talk with a lot of teachers about our pension reform plan. A lot of them think it's fair. If you go to somebody and you say, you get to keep every dollar you've earned, your check's not going to get smaller, but instead of growing at 3% guaranteed every year, it's just going to grow at inflation. A lot of them think that's a fair plan. You know, I mean... So when you actually talk to people and you explain this and you get beyond the fear mongering and the scare tactics used by people who say, you know, pension reform means they're trying to steal your pension check and blah, blah, blah. And you actually, you know, explain to them what it means and the kind of very reasonable common sense reforms that it takes to fix the problem. Most of them are okay with it. It's the politicians who are standing in the way.
But the politicians are beholden to the unions.
Union bosses.
Union bosses. Right. Yeah. Let's make a distinction there. And we haven't seen the effect of Janus yet over time, but we'll start to see it. In the meantime, there's no pushback on the Republican side, because I don't even know if there is a Republican Party or a Republican anything in Illinois after the disasters that we all know too well. So is the Illinois Policy Institute and Scott Stannis and Kristen McQuarrie and sometimes John Cass and maybe Jeff Carlin, that's it? That's the pushback on these.
We'll work with anybody from either side of the aisle who's willing to do the work to pass good ideas, to pass good legislation. So we've got a number of bills we support where we're working with
Democrats.
We've got 15 Democrat chief co-sponsors who are working with us on bills that we support this year. And one of the biggest ones actually directly affects education. We've got a bill for school district consolidation, not school consolidation. Wouldn't close a single school in the state of Illinois, just that top layer of management, that administrative bloat. And
That's safe.
So, right now we spend the most in the nation on what's called general administrative costs. So we spend the most on school districts. And if we match the national average instead, we'd save about $650 million per year. That could be used for property tax relief, or that could be, put back in the classroom rather than a bureaucrat's pocket.
Now, I like the idea in theory. In practice, it's a different deal. Because you start the one reason why people pay high property taxes, and where I know they pay high property taxes, because I do, in the western burbs, for example, is because you have direct control over your district.
Yep.
And God forbid any of those test scores drop below like 100% or 98%. If they drop to 97, the whole neighborhood's freaking out.
I'll give you a little bit of data here on that, because we've looked at other states and how many districts they have per student compared to Illinois.
And the reason, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but the reason that's important is not only because they love their children, but they love their property values.
Yeah, no, it's vitally important. But basically, the bottom line is money that we spend on administration takes money away from teachers' salaries. It takes money away from instructional materials. It takes money away from kids in classrooms where it actually is used to improve test scores. So that's why it's so critical that we reduce that administrative bloat to get more money, because it'll actually improve test scores. So I'll just give you a couple little numbers. We serve about 3,000 students per district on average statewide. Florida serves about 37,000. Okay, they have one school district per county. You can still have your local schools that you control, but you're talking about, you know, these superintendents, assistant superintendents, their staffs. You need 852 in the state of Illinois, which is what we have, 852 school districts. We're the only state in the nation that spent over $1 billion on school district administration. The only one. California, which has about twice our population, spent a third less than us on school district administration.
But what will those superintendents do to get their six-figure pensions?
And then you roll in the fact that they're all going to be making $250,000, $300,000 by the time they die in pension payments.
Or more. There's Troy Paraday, who's a South Chicago suburb superintendent. He had a $440,000 annual compensation. That's going to turn into a pretty nice pension.
I have one policy initiative that I'd like the Illinois Policy Institute to pick up, and I mean priority one.
Okay,
and I've asked this of Ted Dabrowski, too, on the other side. You know him. He's from Wire Points. But
I don't think they can save the Chicago Fire.
No, I don't want... The Chicago Fire should compete. And I'm, as a libertarian, I believe that competition is the best, so relegation is important.
Okay.
If you're at the bottom rung, like the Cubs were on the bottom for years, they should have been dumped down and had some team from Iowa come up in the National League. But that's another story. The story on this is, whenever a politician speaks like they're going to take your pension, or they're doing this terrible thing to the working people, or whatever they say in the newspapers and in the news in general, I want their name, like John Culler, just for hypothetical, pick a Republican, anything. What's your name and comma your party, right? R or D and a hyphen, and then the number that you will receive in pension each year if you retire today.
Yeah,
I want that pension. I want people to see what these jokers are making. You know, they were at the water reclamation district, and then they show up on the state payroll, the highway, and now they're on the, you know, in the legislature. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I want to see that. Can you guys do that? Can that be done?
Well, we've got data. It's on our website about the General Assembly retirement system and how much these people are making and how much they're scheduled to make in their pensions. And it's not just lawmakers. They call it the General Assembly retirement system, but it's also like, agency directors, former governors, all that. And a lot of those people are making six figures when they're starting, and their pensions are going to be, you know, huge by the end of their retirement with that 3% guaranteed
COLA. So you can find that on your website.
Yeah, you can find it on our website. Yep. Illinoispolicy.org.
Just in case you forgot.
Yep. And I should mention that was another part of the pension reform that we're pushing, which is a cap on the maximum pensionable salary. So you can still earn a salary above, say, $110,000, but your pension's still based on $110,000. And the reason for that is because that's a pension reform idea that doesn't touch that $60,000, you know, teacher you were talking about. It doesn't touch the average government worker, but it does actually save a lot of money. And if you're making, you know, $440,000 like Troy Paraday, in my opinion, you can probably afford to set a little bit aside for your own retirement and not rely on a taxpayer subsidized system.
No charge.
Yeah, exactly.
But then that would be bumping up the salary at the last couple of weeks so that the big pension payoff resumes.
Yeah, it would end that practice.
And that would be, that's the Chicago way.
That is the Chicago way.
Yeah.
Adam Schuster of the Illinois Policy Institute, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you very much.
For Adam Schuster of the Illinois Policy Institute, and for Gregory Pratt and Scott Stanis of the Chicago Tribune, and for Jeff Carlin, WGN producer of The Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis, and me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, stay tuned because next week we're coming to you with an interesting story about Jesse Smollett and Mr. Big. I think we may have cracked this case wide open, Jeff. We'll see. So from all of us to all of you, thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way.